This is Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. Lobster biologists around the world are fresh off an international conference held in Portland, Maine last week. One of the organizers of that meeting joins us today with an update on our very own struggling lobster population here in southern New England. Also, when the Human Genome Project was launched, there was a lot of talk about how it would revolutionize medicine. In the years immediately after the project wrapped up, some wondered where all the amazing new advances were. Well, in the past month, FDA has approved two new medicines, one a cancer treatment and the other a drug for cystic fibrosis, both approved for use not based on symptoms, but for specific genetic mutations. Bioethicist Art Kaplan says this is just the tip of the iceberg when it comes to genetic medicine. But it's not just our own genetics that we now understand better. Researchers are probing the genome of malaria to understand how the world's most prevalent parasitic killer is evolving in response to modern medicine. We hear from Diane Wirth later this hour. First, though, NASA announced the latest class of astronaut candidates last week, and one of them is from right here in Woods Hole. Well, she's actually originally from Texas, but she's been working at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution since 2009. She's a research engineer who has worked on both the human-occupied submersible Alvin and its remotely operated cousin Jason. Laurel O'Hara, welcome to Living Lab Radio.
Thank you.
First of all, congratulations. I mean, 18,300 candidates for 12 jobs, and you got one of them. What do you think's driving? I mean, that's the largest candidate class, right? 18,000
yes,
applicants.
It's about twice as many applications as they got.
What do you think's driving all that interest?
I think that a lot of it is just NASA did a great social media campaign for this application round. So when the application opened, they posted a lot on Facebook, on Twitter, on Instagram, and I think that generated a lot of excitement. But then also movies like The Martian and Gravity and The Martian, the book, and then also everything that's going on in commercial space. So SpaceX launches, Blue Origin launches. I just think in general, there's a lot of enthusiasm for space exploration right now.
Well, and a lot of what your class of astronauts will be doing is testing some of those commercial vehicles and then eventually have the potential to be part of those early human expeditions to Mars. Early 2030 is the goal, right, for sending a human out into low orbit around Mars. Is that something that you would want to be part of?
Definitely. I'd be thrilled. I think all of us would be thrilled to take steps on another planet. At the same time, I think we'll also all be thrilled to be involved in anything that we're asked to do.
Well, I was going to ask, what about all the test flights in between? I mean, that's kind of test pilot work, literally, you know, but with space vehicles, both the commercial ones and this new Orion system that NASA's developing, that's risky business.
It is, but it's, you know, it's calculated risk, and NASA's very focused on doing things safely. So, you know, by the time that you actually get onto the vehicle, you know everything about the systems, you know, you've been intimately involved with the whole development process. You know, it's a little bit different of a perspective.
Well, so you're actually, you know, as you're hinting at there, an astronaut candidate starting in August. You've got 2 years of training. What's entailed in that?
Yes. Yeah, so my class will start in August, and from there we'll do flight training in the T-38s. We'll do spacewalk system training in the neutral buoyancy lab, so in the pool with the space station mock-up in flight suits. And we'll learn Russian language skills, and we'll learn robotic skills, and then we'll also be trained in space station systems.
The Russian language skills, mostly just because right now that's what we're using for launches, is we have to go to Russia to actually launch to the International Space Station?
That's correct. So you do spend a good amount of time in Russia working with the Russian team. So you need some Russian. They also know English, so it's a two-way street.
I mean, there are a lot of kids who say they want to be an astronaut when they grow up. You grew up in the Houston area. You
right.
went to space camp. And how many times have you applied to be an astronaut?
This is my third time. So I started applying basically as soon as I thought I met the minimum qualifications. I was kind of on the hairy edge there for the first application. But third time was a charm.
And both your college and your master's degrees are literally in rocket science, aeronautics and aerospace engineering. But you've been doing ocean engineering for several years. How'd you get into the ocean side of things?
Well, for me, I've always had a great a great sense of adventure and just kind of a desire for exploration. And in my early days that took the form, you know, I got hooked on space exploration, probably partially because I grew up with Johnson Space Center right down the road. But then I also always grew up on the ocean, so in Houston, and then I had family in St. Petersburg, Florida, and on Fripp Island in South Carolina. So I grew up just kind of meandering around, swimming in the ocean. I dreamed of having a boat. So I got into grad school and realized that realized that I really wanted to be out there more, like on the frontier, wherever that happened to be. And so I came to Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution and just it kind of felt like I was coming home. It's been an amazing experience.
Yeah, I have to say, though, there's kind of this aspect of getting to know our planet feels a little bit more personal, perhaps, than getting to know the moon or Mars. But maybe that's just my own perspective. There's got to be something very personal that would drive you to want to go to the moon, to go to Mars, to do this kind of deep space exploration. What is that? What's the personal connection there for you?
Really just, I think, curiosity and a desire to go new places and learn new things. And that applies here on Earth. There are places on Earth that are just as remote as places as the moon or Mars or places on other planets.
And what do you think some of your first missions might be as an astronaut?
I don't know. It's too early to tell. NASA has a lot of exciting things going on. And I don't know what the future holds. Right now, I have a lot of training in front of me.
Does that feel intimidating?
No, very exciting. I'm really excited. It's a great group of people. I can't wait to get to know them and work with them over the next 2 years and just learn, you know, as much as we can.
How much time have you guys spent together? It's 12 of you, right?
Yeah, for the most part, most of them we've spent just the last couple days together. So I've known them for all of 3 days. It's a group, though, that's really easy to get to know. They're very personable and just very well-rounded individuals.
How tight-knit is an astronaut class? I mean, how much interaction do you have with the other astronaut classes, or are you kind of your own little pod doing your own thing?
For the first 2 years of training, we are kind of our own little pod. Astronauts in the past have described it like you basically become each other's brothers and sisters over that period because you literally spend, you know, the majority of your time together in all sorts of crazy situations, you know, doing wilderness survival training or flying in planes or whatever it happens to be. So it's very tight knit. But then the broader you join the astronaut office and that's also a very tight knit group.
I imagine. I mean, you've got to be. You're really thinking about being out in space and your lives depend on each other.
I mean, they say during the application process that the whole time they're kind of thinking about, you know, who would I, well, first be willing to be stuck in a small can with for potentially months to years on end, but also, you know, who will I trust with my life? So it's pretty serious undertaking.
I mean, for the past several years as an ocean engineer, you've worked on Alvin, the human-occupied submersible. Have you ever gone down in Alvin?
I have. I got one dive on sea trials of the new sub in 2013.
I mean, that's got to be the closest thing on this planet to the experience of going out into space, being in that tight space for one, and then also going to this completely alien frontier, essentially.
Oh, yeah. And I think I remember very distinctly, so when we're diving, before the ascent, we drop weights and then actually shut down all the lights to come back to the surface to conserve battery power. And so on that dive, you know, we were a mile deep at our deepest point. We dropped the weights, shut off all the lights, and started the ascent. And very distinctly, I remember just looking out the window the whole way up, just looking out and seeing all the bioluminescence, just sea creatures lighting up all over the place. And I imagine that was probably at the time I thought, you know, that was about as close as I'd gotten to going to space. So
sounds kind of pretty incredible. Floating through space, seeing a bunch of stars.
Yes.
Laurel O'Hara is a research engineer at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution and now a member of the newest class of astronaut candidates at NASA. She reports for duty in August. Laurel, best of luck and thanks for coming in.
Thank you very much.
When it comes to the iconic fisheries of New England, lobster is a close second only to cod, but it's not doing so well in southern New England. And some have called Maine's booming lobster industry a gilded trap. So what's wrong with lobster? The challenges facing New England's lobsters were a major topic of discussion last week at an international workshop on lobster biology in Portland, Maine. And joining me now is Carrie LaValle. She's a senior lecturer of natural sciences and mathematics at Boston University, and she was one of the organizers of that lobster conference. Also, Beth Cassoni. She's executive director of the Massachusetts Lobstermen's Association. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Carrie, on a scale of 1 to 10, where 10 is thriving and 1 is, you know, basically gone or dead, where is the southern New England lobster population at this point?
Well, Beth Cassoni could probably give you better information than I could, but I would say it's probably at a 3-ish. And that's because of some challenges with not only disease, but also high temperatures in the area.
Well, that's what I was going to ask. How much of a factor is climate change in this versus something like overfishing or maybe a more direct human impact?
Rather than a direct human impact such as fishing, it really is more of a climate change picture. Certainly a lot of the talks at the conference, particularly in the disease section, implicated temperature as one of the major problems that was causing the incidence of shell disease, and it was also causing a major change in the shell's microbiome. So temperature has a major effect. And then other implicated things are things such as heavy metals being present in water, certainly anything that humans do like oil spills or other kinds of organic enrichment. But I really wouldn't put this on fisheries at all.
Beth, in the cod fishery, there's a lot of mistrust between the fishermen who are out there on the water and the scientists who are feeding information to regulators about the state of the population, a lot of mistrust of those actual stock assessments. Is there any of that debate or divide about the state of the southern New England lobster population?
Well, the southern New England lobster population has endured a multitude of stresses, as Carrie alluded to. Our fishers have been seeing high increases of runoff from power plants, and also there's been a strong odor in the New Bedford area of bleach in the water. So that's coming from, where is that coming from? That's coming from humans running off the land. And the predation factor in southern New England has risen exorbitantly. And
what do you mean by that, the predation factor?
The predation, it's single species management, where they're managing one species individually. And black sea bass, I'll give you an example. Black sea bass has exploded in southern New England because of the warming waters. And we've seen, you know, plenty of photographs. Every fish that's cut open has 8 to 10 to 12 baby lobsters in them. So they're eating juvenile lobsters before they can reach sexual maturity, so they can't reproduce. And, you know, going back to your statement about the stock assessments and the cod stock assessments, I've seen some pretty interesting videography done by SMAST, and they have the technologies now where they've built a modeling program where they can use an open cod end so there's no mortality. It's really unfortunate that the way historically stock assessments have been done is where there's mortality. It's almost 100% mortality to the species that they're assessing. And this open cod end concept has great retention. I think the only mortality is the 5 to 20 that they might sample the contents of their stomach. And it's definitely gaining some momentum for the cod survey. And we have our state survey done by the Gloria Michelle, and that's with a small mesh bottom trawler. And you know, we kind of scratch our head at the use of the data, because you don't use lobster pots to catch groundfish, so why are they using the small mesh bottom trawlers to sample lobsters? You know, it's almost a double-edged sword. And just to go back to southern New England for a minute, southern New England is a very large area that ranges from the south coast of Massachusetts down to Virginia and up into Long Island Sound. And we're in the process right now of going through Addendum 25 at the Atlantic States Marine Fisheries Commission. And the one thing that the industry would like to see done collectively is to have the target threshold reevaluated. And what that does is it sets the bar for where the stock should be at And to look at historic high thresholds, it's almost like a never achievable goal in that stock, where the waters are climbing slowly and the stock is not going to be able to achieve that historic high threshold. And then the other thing, too, that was brought up is Long Island Sound, which is part of southern New England, into Area 6 from just Connecticut into New York. That area has been, it used to be the boom. I mean, that's where the lobsters used to be landed. And now there's nothing. I mean, they've gone from thousands of fishermen to a couple of hundred. And we really want to have that area reevaluated and also the Buzzards Bay area reevaluated, because they're such hostile environments for lobsters. And if you keep those areas into the modeling program for the stock assessment, it's a complete negative, false number, in that it just drives down the overall stock. The fishermen that are still fishing in southern New England are moving out to deeper, colder waters where the lobsters are. There's a handful of guys in Massachusetts and Rhode Island area, too, that are near shore fishermen. And when I say a handful, I'm talking maybe 150 to 200 fishermen, when there used to be thousands.
Carrie, you know, the lobster fishery has been in various places in southern New England closed on and off over the past 5 years. There's also, I know at the conference there was a lot of talk about the idea of marine protected areas. I mean, stopping fishing, protecting parts of the ocean, that can't stop the rise in water temperature. If that's really what's affecting the lobster population, you know, bringing it down to this 3 out of 10 level where it is now, what's the future prognosis, and is there anything we can do that's effective to try to bolster these populations?
So MPAs are kind of an interesting phenomena. It doesn't do you really that much good to close things down for a short period of time. The best work that's been done on MPAs has been done in Europe, and it has been a very long-term situation. But you have to remember that Europe overfished their fisheries way back in the 1700s and 1800s, so they're already dealing with much lower stocks than we ever have seen. The one study that was presented at the conference on an MPA that had been in existence for 25 years did show a rise in biomass in lobster and other fish, but that's a very long-term solution, and that doesn't help people who are economically dependent on this fishery. As Beth said, the real issue with lobsters in southern New England is that they are moving into deeper, colder waters, and only certain fishermen with certain size vessels can get out into those waters. And if they continue to move deeper and deeper, that is going to even make it harder for coastal fishermen to fish those lobsters. So MPAs in that area are not really going to help anything. Fisheries closures, they would have to be very, very long-term to see any kind of effect. And in coastal areas, it's not going to make any difference. Also, as Beth indicated, the fact that we have many, many predators moving up from the south that these lobsters have never seen before and really do not know how to interact with is a significant issue. One of the more interesting studies that was in a Monday session on behavioral ecology showed that it really does matter if lobsters have seen a predator, a new predator, before or if they have not. So, for example, this was looking at the black sea bass, and it was looking at how lobsters in southern New England and in parts of Massachusetts reacted to those animals versus how lobsters in Maine reacted to those animals, and they saw differences in the lobster's behavior. Massachusetts and southern New England lobsters seem to say, yeah, I know that you're a black bass, and I better stay the heck away from you, and lobsters in Maine had no clue. And so they were more naive about these predators and more likely to encounter them. This means that the population has to learn. They literally have to learn how to deal with the predators, and they have to learn how to become more predator sensitive. And those animals that don't learn that die. they get eaten. And it's not just going to be the black sea bass that's a problem. It's going to be other subtropical fishes who aren't so much swallowers but are smashers. And if you look at all of the literature on mollusks, there's a reason that mollusks down south have spines on their shells, and that's to prevent these smashers from getting them. There's a reason that spiny lobsters are spiny. Our lobsters do not have those features, and so if they have to now deal with a predator who just literally drives themselves at the lobster like a kamikaze pilot, our lobsters are not going to win that war. So we have a lot of problems going on, but it really is, as Beth said, it's an ecosystem problem. So you can't just look at it as a single fishery management issue. It's a whole ecosystem problem as the ecosystems completely change over time. And this is going to be a real challenge for not just Southern New England fisheries, but eventually for Maine fisheries as well as the waters keep warming. The Gulf of Maine is one of the fastest temperature-changing water area in the entire country. So we have some significant issues ahead of us.
Those lobsters have a steep learning curve in the face of climate change. Carrie LaValle is a senior lecturer at Boston University, one of the organizers of last week's International Lobster Conference. Beth Cassoni is executive director of the Massachusetts Lobstermen's Association. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Living Lab Radio continues after a short break.